Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at thomisticinstitute.org.
Long known and praised in Italy, English translations have turned the novelist Elena Ferrante into something of a literary sensation. Her books have received a lot of attention. There's television series, movies in the works, and so on. The fiction, on the other hand, while well-regarded, is about as despair-ridden as you can imagine. Very little hope. One of her novellas, called The Days of Abandonment, begins with Olga's husband blandly announcing that he's leaving her. As it's described in the book, Mario closed the front door carefully and was gone, with Olga's anguish and rage growing within her. She's terrified that she is going to turn into a woman that she remembers from her childhood in the neighborhood who had been abandoned, who no longer even had a name but was simply known as the Poverella, that poor woman. Abandoned, Olga is in free fall. She views herself as unloved and she loves no one in return. She views her own children as loathsome and repellent. They have consumed her, she feels. First Mario, and then the children. And she is like, these are her words, a lump of food that my children had chewed without stopping, a cud made of living material to allow two greedy bloodsuckers to nourish themselves. The morning after her own failed an attempt to have an affair, she wakens in a state of profound disorientation. She's suffering vertigo of both space and time. She's confusing grammatical tenses of past, present, and future. And then things go very badly. Her daughter, young daughter Ilaria, complains that the brother, Gianni, had been ill in the night, throwing up in Ilaria's bed and suffering a dangerously high fever. As she cleans up the mess, Olga fixates not on her children, but on her own perceived loss of beauty. A loss inevitable, she thinks, for all women, turning all into the Poverella. Again, Gianni is sick. Again, she cleans him. And as she does so, she sinks into a sort of madness. She cannot read the thermometer. She struggles to maintain focus, to pay attention, certain that she had arrived at the edge of some precipice and now, in her words, were falling. In the middle of this madness, an awful odor confronts her. Not her son's, but the bloody stool, drool, and vomit of her dog, perhaps poisoned by insecticide that she used for ants. To her disgust, the dog squirms into the master's study, the husband who has abandoned her. As if looking for comfort from Mario, Gianni, the son, requests that she call daddy, never mind that he's useless, a deadbeat father, and that she is there with Gianni when he needs her. But he repeats, but call daddy. Daddy, the one who knew what to do. Olga says, daddy has left. We have to manage by ourselves. Olga eventually gathers herself enough wits to try and call both the vet and the doctor. The telephone, however, does not work, emitting only a faint hiss because she has neglected to pay the bill. The cell phone, too, is broken in half, broken by her in an earlier fit of rage. She tries to rubber band the cell phone together, which, of course, doesn't work. She has no connection to the outside world. She is in her days of abandonment. She decides to leave the apartment to get help, but the key gets stuck in the lock and she can't turn it. It's jammed, immovable, and she can't break down the door because some months before she had hired contractors to reinforce it in order to keep herself safe. The key won't turn. She can't extract it from the lock. The door is too strong to pry off its hinges. She's trapped. At that point, Olga again reverts back to the third person. She's disassociating. And the scene is really intense. Ants are swarming the dog. The phones provide no connection. The apartment block is empty. Everyone in Naples is at the shore in the heat of August, and the door is immovable. She's trapped in this room with its disgusting stench of death. Trying to phone, she hoped for a sort of magic, but then says, what results is nothing, nothing, nothing. Eventually, the dog dies with an intense pain and a final bark. Olga bursts in tears. Suddenly, at that moment, without warning, the doorbell rings, prompting this response from her daughter, Ilaria. Daddy, she murmurs, full of hope. It is not her father. Her hope is for naught. For Olga, there is no beyond. She's trapped in the room. There's no landline, no cell phone, no exit. She's confined within, which she describes as being confined with nothing, nothing, nothing. And we, within the room, within her apartment, illness, confusion, stench, and death. Now, it couldn't be more blunt as I read the text. There once was a daddy who could have acted and helped. In other words, the age of belief in God the Father. But daddy has gone. Moderns consider themselves alone in this universe, many of them at least, with no God. They are encased within immanence only, nothing beyond the universe of matter, nothing beyond the universe of force and motion, encased within immanence with no connection to the transcendent beyond. And what remains in Ferrante, and which I think is the case for a whole lot of people, is a view that we are stuck with this illness which is life, already within a trajectory towards death. Now, you might say that's merely fiction, and of course it is, but it seems to me that it's fiction which is deeply relevant to how our culture understands or misunderstands happiness and the good life. We are, I think, living in what Charles Taylor, the distinguished Canadian philosopher, describes as a disenchanted world. For us moderns, the cosmos is no longer full of spirits and gods, fairies and forms, but only causal forces that we harness to our own needs. Taylor uses this example. When there's a bump in the night, you don't first think that it's a demon. It would be embarrassing to think that. You first think, oh good, it's only a burglar. Whereas for the medieval, you might think first, oh, it's a demon. And those of us who do think it's first a demon, we don't tell our neighbors about it. In fact, we're often nervous to tell even our priests that we think such a thing. The disenchanted universe, while it has given unprecedented technical and economic progress, leads also, Taylor suggests, to a wide sense of malaise, a sense that the world is flat and empty, that it has no vertical feel to it. It's just horizontal. For Taylor, this is true even for those of us moderns who retain faith. As he puts it, everyone, even religious believers, begin from within what he calls the immanent frame. So we have these picture frames, right? Imagine what's on the outside of the frame is transcendence, the beyond, the eternal. We begin from within the frame of immanence, like Olga within her apartment. We're trying to see if we can pierce through immanence to get to the divine. But for a lot of modern people, we are bereft of transcendence. Taylor suggests that this world makes possible what he calls exclusive humanism. Exclusive humanism is the form of humanism which accepts no goals other than human flourishing, where human flourishing is defined in reductive fashions: increased GDP, a new cell phone, clean water, clean air, clean teeth. That's it. That's the point of life. And as a result, we are consumed, or almost consumed as moderns, with quantifiable rather than goods of quality. We're concerned with a higher SAT score, a larger bank account, a bigger summer house, a faster ski boat, and greater returns in our investments. And that's it. That is the limit of concern when there is merely the horizontal. Now, if I'm right about that, the contemporary West, as fictionalized by Ferrante, lives within the immanent frame, an immanent frame which attempted in its own understanding to save the human things from the superstitious realm of the medievals and the supernatural. But what it does, on the other hand, is strip away human action. It replaces human action with technological reductions. It removes human freedom to merely comfort and power. We view the world as force and processes. That's it. But it's very difficult for men and women to live out their lives and become fully authentic, free selves, created in the image of God, when the institutions in which they are formed, education, family, politics, even some forms of religion, are stripped, enervated, decadent, and moldering away. We want to be happy, of course, but we have very little idea what that means. And our institutions increasingly tell us that happiness is merely immanent, exclusive humanism, and the flourishing of more progress, more technology. You shouldn't be surprised, then, that if you do a Google search for the words epidemic and loneliness, you'll find a lot of hits. People in our society are incredibly lonely. If you read the statistics, you'll find that an enormous percentage of young people indicate that they have not a single real friend, not one, no one they could call in a moment of need. There's many online connections, but no friends. Mark Lilla of Columbia says that we have become stripped of our sense of belonging, a sense that we belong to other people and belong to something like a nation or a city. As he puts it, quoting from him, "We live in a hyper-individualistic bourgeois society. Among all the ideas or beliefs or feelings that once muted or softened the American demand for individual autonomy, they've evaporated." This is still Lilla. "What's left is thin, atomistic, personal choice, individual rights, and self-definition." He says that we speak those words as if they are a wedding vow. We hear them so often that it's hard for us to think in any other terms except self-regarding terms, terms about ourselves. Now, that's true in education as well. I spend most of my time working with college students, and I think we certainly see it there. You may notice that in our society, there is an obsession with college and degrees as somehow the key to a good life, to happiness. In what was then a widely noted essay some years ago, Bill Dershowitz, then of Yale, wrote that the nation's top colleges were turning their kids into zombies, his words. He says that while many of his students were bright, thoughtful, creative kids, most of them were content to color within the lines. Very few, he says, were passionate about ideas. Very few saw college as a larger project of intellectual discovery. Everyone dressed as if they were ready to be interviewed at a moment's notice. Dershowitz continues, "Look beneath the facade of seamless well-adjustment, and what you'll often find," he says, "are toxic levels of fear, anxiety, and depression, of emptiness, aimlessness, and isolation. The great fear is not being successful. That's what's terrifying and disorienting. The cost of falling short, even temporarily, is not a merely practical consideration of, oh, I didn't get the job. It's an existential failure." Mark Schiffman, a friend of mine, who now teaches at the seminary in San Francisco, says that that students at the contemporary university are not majoring in physics or chemistry, certainly not in philosophy. He says what they're majoring in is fear. It's a good line. Now, I hesitate to say it because it sounds too quick, but if any of that's true, it implies that we're not living our lives very well. Now, I don't think this is merely about college students either. I think many of them are acting the way they've been taught to act by their parents and schools and role models. It seems to me that a whole lot of people in our society live hurried, hasty, anxious lives, uncertain of purpose. We're not sure what purpose is. Now, we all wish to be happy, but try to be happy if we don't know what it is. What it is we are seeking, well, that feels like a dead end. Now, because we live within the imminent frame, if Taylor is right, it's very easy for us to judge our own value. I know I do it. Not by who we are, but rather by what we have or do or produce or consume. It seems in our society to matter very little that she is a just woman or he is a courageous man. Instead, we ask and are most concerned with what college did they attend? What were the SAT scores? What's their professional attainment? How much do they make? Even better, how much do they spend? What is had and what is done seems to matter to us a whole lot more than who and what we are in our characters. John Paul II says that we are consumed with having rather than with being. Consequently, our society praises attainment above all else, including at times, it seems to me, success rather than character. Now, if that's true, it seems all but inevitable that we will have a society of anxious striving, where everything is done instrumentally as a tactic or a ploy or a game, rather than doing things for their own sake. Years ago, already in the 50s and early 60s, the Italian philosopher Augusto Del Noce predicted what a culture like this would look like. arguing that it would embrace a kind of negative critique of thick moral value. It would deride, and it would tear apart, and it would mock words like nobility, sacrifice, courage, fidelity, without having much to replace those old words with. Instead, what would remain, or what would come to be, would be an open and thus endless quest for choice, comfort, and satisfaction. It would be, in other words, a disenchanted world lacking a sense of purpose. Here's a more simple way of putting it. For many modern people, the world is not understood the way that God understands the world. If you think of Genesis 1, God repeats to us many times that he views the world as good, 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 indeed very good. You may know those lines from Chesterton, I'm going to misquote them, but where Chesterton asks, why is the world so old? Anyone know this text? Why is the world so old? Well, he says that God is like a child. So I have five children. When they were little, one of my favorite things to do was to put them on top of the fridge and then walk away. Because what do they do as you walk away? Not one ever fell, by the way. As you walk away, what does the three-year-old child do? Well, she's horrified. She calls you back. You get her off, she hugs your neck, and what immediately does she say? Do it again. Again. Do it again. You put her on the fridge, you walk away, she shrieks, you get her, she hugs your neck, and then she says, do it again. Chesterton's point is, every morning God says, again? Do it again. And it's why the world is so old. Look at the youthfulness of God, the delight that God has in the world. Are you sensing that in our culture, that people view their lives and the world as good and good and good, or that they are anxiously striving for something else? Well, that's the cheery part of the talk. I had a book come out in December called Lost in the Chaos, Imminence, Despair, and Hope. When my wife read it, she said, I saw the despair. Where is the hope? And I said, did you get to chapter 9? She said, no, I didn't get to chapter 9. Barely made it through chapter 2. And I said, well, chapter 9 was about Mary. And she said, why didn't you just write chapter 9? Against that kind of despair are certain truths of the Catholic faith. These truths have always been true. They will always be true. And yet they are perhaps needed to be said and proclaimed and understood and received with a special urgency just now. As the West creaks and groans farther along into post-Christianity, it has neglected or truncated these truths, upon which it depends. It's as if the form has lost its spirit, or, this is a talk for the Thomistic Institute, it's as if the matter has lost the form. It's as if matter has lost the form. And form, of course, is the act of the matter. It's unsurprising to me that as the West becomes more post-Christian and has forgotten these truths, it becomes more isolated, fragmented, alienated, and unhappy. Now, what I'd like to suggest for your consideration tonight is two Christian and very Thomistic claims, which I think need to be rediscovered and reappropriated in the moment. The first is the idea of the person, and the second is the idea that the good seeks to communicate or diffuse itself as widely as possible. First, the person. Second, the idea that the good seeks to communicate or diffuse itself as widely as possible. Now, I can give you a simple definition of the person from Boethius and Aquinas. It goes like this. A person is an individual substance of a rational nature. Well, that really gets the heart pumping, doesn't it? I am an individual substance of a rational nature. Okay, I think that's a true definition, but it's not especially evocative, is it? It doesn't really tell us what to do or why the person is so special. So let's look at two theological truths to unpack what the tradition has meant by the person. Let's first start with the Trinity, and then let's look at what's going on in Genesis 2. So let's think about the Trinity for a moment. It's a Friday night. What better thing could there be to do than to think about the Trinity? The Trinity is three persons in one being. We do not say three individuals in one being, because then we would have three gods. We say three persons in one being. Consubstantial, we say. Very light from light, true God from true God, right? One being, but three persons. But even though there is one being, there is a principle of giving and receiving within the Trinity. Do you remember the old drawings from catechism class? There's a triangle, and in the middle it says God and Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. The Father is God, the Son is God, the Holy Spirit is God, right? They all relate back to the inner of the triangle. But then on the outside of the triangle, the Father is not the Son is not the Father is not the Holy Spirit, the Son is not the, and on it goes. They are distinct. There is a principle of gift and receipt. In the technical language of the Creed, we say that the Father begets the Son, and the Son is begotten. Now, of course, we say that this is an eternal begetting. The Son is not created. That would make us heretics. We call that Arianism, so let's avoid that. The Son is not created, but the Son is begotten. The Father, in fact, gives or begets the Godhead of the Son. He gives the divine nature to the Son. Now, think about how gifts work. Have you ever given a gift away and then immediately wished you had it back? Because if you give it away, who has it? Well, they do, and you want it back. Okay, I think that's problem number one. Problem number two, has anyone given you a gift that was unexpected, you know, that sort of awkward, oh, but I don't have anything for you? Or has given you something that's too generous, too excessive? You know, you have a Wawa $5 gift card for them, and they've given you what you really hoped for. Have you had that experience? Is it a good experience? Do you like it? No, it's terrible because you feel diminished and indebted, yes? So what does the Father give to the Son? He gives the Godhead to the Son. The divine nature is given to the Son. Not created, but given to the Son. Does the Father lose anything in giving the divine nature to the Son? Was there 100 units of God stuff that the Father had? And now the Father has only 99 units left. No. The Father is not diminished. Now, does the Father keep anything back? No, he gives the entirety of the divine nature to the Son, because the Son is equally God, light God from light, true God from true God, light from light, right? Consubstantial. So the Father gives the entirety of the divine nature which he has and is to the Son, without holding anything back. The Son receives the entirety of the divine nature which the Father gives without remaining. But does the Son become less or indebted or diminished by receiving? Well, no, because then he wouldn't be true God from true God. He would be something other than God if he was less or diminished. So the Father gives perfectly and without remainder and loses nothing. The Son receives perfectly of the entirety that the Father has given, which is the divine nature of the Son. And what does the Son offer back? Love. Love. In the Christian West, we say that the Holy Spirit is spirated from the Father and the Son. This word spirated is a very good one. Spiration, to breathe. Yes? So, St. Bernard says, if you want to have an image of the Trinity, it's just a Trinity. The Father, think of breath. The Father is the one who kisses. The Son is the one who is kissed. And the kiss itself is the Holy Spirit. The breathing back and forth of gift, reception, and giving back of love and delight is the Holy Spirit itself. Now, that's a better version of the person, is it not? Now, here's what I think it indicates. The most real principle in the universe is the Trinity. So years ago, before I was Catholic, there was a sister of Mother Teresa's order who took me out to lunch, and this is in Boston, she had made a pilgrimage to St. Pat's to pray for my conversion. And she came and she said, hey, I went to the side chapel of Elizabeth Ann Seton to pray for your conversion. My prayers are always answered, so you might. It felt vaguely threatening. After we converted, we immediately came up that weekend, side chapel, Elizabeth Ann Seton, to offer our thanks. But she said, hey, let's go for lunch. Sure, sister. And I get there, and there's the head of the New England province of Jesuits waiting for me. Totally tricked me. And he says, you know, never forget this. Hey, what's the most important Christian doctrine? I was a young Protestant. I'm sorry, I'm walking away from the recording device. He said, what's the most important Christian doctrine? I was a young Protestant, so I said, justification by faith alone. And he looked at me. I never forget the sadness in his eyes. And he said, the Trinity? The most real principle is the Trinity. And the Trinity is a communion of persons who give and receive without remainder or diminishment or loss. That's the principle which is the origin of the universe and which the universe is made in its likeness and some of the universe in its image. That is what it is to be real, is to be in communion. That's the Trinitarian principle. Second story. It's like unto the first. Humans are created in the image and likeness of God. If God is a communion of persons, it's not unreasonable to think that humans are for communion. That's what we're for. If we're created in the image of God and God is communion, we're for communion. Now, of course, ultimately the communion from where we come and to where we are headed is to be in communion with God. Yes? And yet, in Genesis 2, we have this remarkable story that God wishes for something even in addition to that, as a supplement to that, as a training for that. So earlier I mentioned how in Genesis 1 we're told it's good, 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 very good. If you read Theology of the Body, you know where I'm going here. And God says something quite remarkable in Genesis 2. It's not good. Now, this is a remarkable story if one thinks about it. Adam is hanging out in the Garden of Eden. This is prior to the fall, prior to original sin, prior to concupiscence. Yes? He has the grace of original justice. His body follows his soul. His appetites follow his will. Both his appetites and his will follow his reason. We have an image that somehow he's in conversation with God. They seem to be like walking and chatting in the coolness of the afternoon. Seems pretty good to me. Does Adam complain? Does Adam say, yeah, this is the Garden of Eden is great, but you know what I would like? A boat. You know what I would like? I would like to go to NYU. This is great, but it's not the Hamptons. It's just the East Hampton. Adam doesn't say that. God says it. God says it's not good. Now, do you suppose that Adam had any idea what God meant? Has Adam experienced evil, death, loss, a world that's somehow corrupt? He's in the Garden of Eden. So God says it's not good. Do you imagine that Adam knew what he meant? No. So God has to teach Adam what it means for something not to be good. So give me some poetical license here, okay? It's in the text. I'm going to be, you know, do some poesy with it. So we have this hilarious story of the parade of the animals, yes? I love this story. I love thinking about this story. So I sort of imagine Adam pulling up in his chair. And here come the animals. He's going to name them. And he's going to realize that he's not like the animals, yes? That he is alone in the universe, unlike them. None of them are fit for him. So here comes the first animal. It's a giraffe. In the Song of Solomon, long necks are praised, but this one's a little long. I mean, there's towers of ivory and all, but look at this thing. The next one comes by. It's the rhinoceros. I don't know what I'm supposed to do with this. There's an otter. They look cute, but they're mean. Here's a cat. Now he knows there's evil. Here comes the platypus. I mean, we've already met the duck. We've already met the beaver. We've already met the kangaroo. What is this thing? Send that one to Australia. He's alone. None of them are like him. He's being trained that something is off. Now, what's off? Well, metaphysically, Adam is and cannot but be a human person created in the image of God. He's a human being created in the image of God. It's what he is. But in Thomistic language, we'd call that first act. Second act is the doing that follows from the being. The doing that follows from the being. Now, Adam is created in the image of God. He is created as a person. Can he do the person thing? Or allow me to try to articulate this by moving my hands, which is always the good way to do this. Adam is in the image of God. I want you to imagine that image is now a verb. Can he image God? Well, what is it that God's inner life is? The sharing between persons. The communion of persons. Can Adam alone image, in the verb sense, God? So, God puts him to sleep, the rib, Eve, and what does he say? At last. Right, God has been teaching him a certain kind of desire. This one is not right for me, this one is not right for me, this one is not right for me, this one's not right for me, that's the platypus, right? Now, if you've dated recently, sorry, sorry, it's awful, I recall, you know. If at one point, you know, one Friday, this one's not right for me, the next Friday, that one's not right for me, the next Wednesday, this one's not right for me, Saturday brunch, this one's not right for me, the next Saturday brunch, there's only so much toast and eggs one can eat, what does one begin to conclude? That none of these are right for me or something far worse? That I'm not right for any, that I am alone. Okay, here's Eve, one that is fit for him. Did he have to say yes to Eve? No. There's a fiat here, in a sense, is there not? Could he have said, no thanks, I'll stick with my dog? Man's best friend. He could have. If he had said no to Eve, let's think about what he would have been saying no to. He'd have been saying no to God because God has helped him, yes. He'd be saying no to Eve, obviously. But what else would he be saying no to? Himself. Because what is he for? Communion. He's for communion. If he had said no to Eve, he would have decided, this, by the way, I'm not making a claim about marriage here. This is about the human person. This is prior to marriage. This is independent. This is philosophical anthropology. It's not about getting married or not getting married. This is what we are for, created in the image of God, is communion. And what does communion do? What does the good do? It seeks to diffuse itself as widely as possible. The Father gives the entirety of the Godhead to the Son. The Father and the Son in communion spirate the Holy Spirit. This is not to create, to spirate the Holy Spirit. It is fitting for a being like that to create the universe. It is fitting, Thomas says, to create a universe with all of the different stuff in the universe, because otherwise we wouldn't be able to even remotely understand the infinity of God. It is fitting to create one who is in his image. And then what is it fitting for ones created in the image of God to do? To share. To communicate ourselves as widely as possible. I think that's good news. I think those are truths of the faith that should be articulated again and again and appropriated some more. But I also want to suggest this. However important it is to get the definition of the person correct, however important it is to get theory correct, theory is one thing and living is quite another. You can be able to recite the definition of a person. You may have impeccable Trinitarian theology. I hope that Father Boniface and Father Jonas say that my own Trinitarian account there was adequate. I got a thumbs up. You can have all the theories right in the world and not be living well. So I have four suggestions of concrete practices so that we can seek to communicate goodness as widely and as completely as possible and to constitute and make as much as we can communion with others for their good and our own. Ways of imaging as the verb, God. First, keep the Sabbath. In fact, all my suggestions are really Sabbath suggestions, things we could do to recover the Sabbath as a day of leisure. No, not of rest, not of entertainment, not of play, but leisure, which is itself a kind of communion. Another way of putting it is that priests and parents and friends ought to exert the full range of their intelligence and will to making Sunday a day of richness and fecundity rather than a day of rest or entertainment and football and shopping and laundry and business as usual. Keep the Sabbath. Second,
study and story, especially on Sundays.
The reading of good books, especially spiritual reading, has made more than a few saints. Reading has made more than a few saints. But we tend not to study or to read very much. At a time like ours, which Joseph Pieper calls a time of existential poverty, we've got fat wallets and thin souls in our society. Fat wallets compared to all of human history, and thin souls compared to most of human history. We should be able to read some books that give life to us again, that perhaps allow us to learn to see. If you know that wonderful image from The Abolition of Man by C.S. Lewis, Lewis says he would rather that we have the emotions form our appetites than pure theory alone. This is how virtue works, right? Virtue is the exercise of reason, which gets our choices and our wills and our affections in between two extremes. But virtue is always an education in the affections. Always an education in the affections. Lewis puts it this way. We want reason, the head, to rule the belly, appetites, through the chest, right? Through the sense of spirit and honor, I would add joy. So I want to suggest that if you didn't get a chance to read the books as a child, which create that kind of moral imagination, it's not too late. Form your moral imagination with those kind of living books which make you love what's good and delight in what's good. I'm talking about things like Clever Little Birds and the Burgess Animal Stories. Reread Peter Rabbit. Read Narnia. Read about the heroes and villains in Plutarch. Stories of King Alfred, brave little toy canoes that make their way down rivers and streams. Persistent turtles in Aesop. Children love those stories, don't they? Because they're revealing what's good. And the good is that which causes desire, with that which is desired. And the beautiful is that in which we delight. If we can't delight in the beautiful, we're probably also not going to see the good. Now, if Sabbath is first and study and story is second, beauty is my third, which I already hinted at. One of the great fractures of contemporary society is its loss of beauty. And perhaps no particular group in our community, in our society, has experienced that loss more than Catholics have. Our tradition of architecture, art, and sacred music was broken in some sort of calamity. It's no accident that in film and television, when they want to portray religion, either good or bad, usually as bad, they portray it as Catholic. And it's no accident that the Catholicism they portray is the Catholicism of chant, polyphony, stained glass, Gothic architecture, votive candles, Caravaggio, and St. Peter's. Why? Because one notices these things. They strike us. They seem to us awful, full of awe. Too often the word beauty implies a certain kind of snobbishness, right? As if we're talking only about the opera here. But the point of beauty is not so that we can, the point of learning beauty is not so that we can have a kind of dilettante smattering of cocktail party conversations about cave drawings and the opera. Those are interesting things. If you like cave drawings and the opera, I'm all for it. But, and they're worth knowing. But the real goal of beauty is to help us be in touch and to delight in reality. To be in touch with reality and to delight in reality. That's the point. The deep, wondrous truth and delightful goodness of the world again and again. Fourth, so Sabbath, story, beauty. Fourth, in some way the culmination of the first three is feasting. We don't feast in our society. We have a lot of parties, Joseph Pieper says, but not so many feasts. Catholicism loves stuff. I was scandalized by Catholics' love of stuff when I was a Protestant. This is a religion of water, wine, and food. Salvation in part comes from bread, which is no longer bread. And our entire life is organized around bread, which is no longer bread. It looks like bread, and it's not. It's no accident, then, that we feast. And the meaning of those feasts, especially the great feast of the Eucharist, is a kind of extravagant recognition of the magnanimous goodness of God who gives without needing receipt from us. I used to be horrified. I grew up in a ranch and a farm. I used to be horrified by the story of the parable of the sower. Right? The sower is God. He's throwing seeds on rocky soil. That's dumb. My dad would never throw seeds
in our, you know, enormous air seeder in Alberta, on rocky soil or alkaline soil, or you put it in the good soil. But God's bag of seed, right, this is grace, is infinite. He is not diminished. He's almost profligate in casting seed wherever it may go. When you feast, really feast, you don't count the cost. You do it because it's good to do. When we feast, we're getting trained to have Eucharistic lives. We're being trained to actually receive the Eucharist well, and we're being trained to, in our own way, be like God who gives and delights in giving. Eucharist is a celebration of communion. It's communion. That's what we call it. Now, perhaps I should put it more directly, thinking back to the first unhappy part of the talk. I'm suggesting that, among other things, we need to outjoy our cultured despisers. But of course, you can't just will yourself into that. You have to be trained into that. So our Sunday should be full of feasting, and especially feasting with dancing. You can do this. I don't mean the dance at the club. I don't mean that. I mean communal dancing, where you pass off partner to partner and you are learning some sort of folk music or something. I'm going to quote myself here. That's obnoxious, but I'm going to quote myself. I haven't found anything better. After a bout of folk dancing with friends, I once wrote the following. It was an ironclad rule of the schools and religious communities of my youth that dancing was forbidden. It was a prohibition enforced with the same rigor as the edict to not drink, smoke, or chew, or go with girls who do. So I don't know how to dance. Recently, my wife and some friends threw a party culminating in traditional line dance. It was like Jane Austen stuff, back and forth. I had not done that before, and I went to the party somewhat hesitant. But there we all were, jammed together in an overheated room, stomping and clapping, bowing and twirling to the fiddle and the guitar. Mostly, though, we were exulting. I held my youngest daughter to her shrieking delight as her older sister and I do-si-do'd and promenaded, and a triumphant son of mine somehow convinced an older and quite pretty partner to stoop down to his level. Unlike other days, teenage boys cannot escape their mother's arms, and I saw mums so jubilant and merry and relieved at this that they paraphrased Simeon, "Lord, let your servant now depart in peace." Grandfathers with granddaughters, husbands with wives, friends with friends, a few yearning adolescents with hearts beating time to another more ancient reel. In that sweltering, overcrowded room, you could hear the music and see us leaping, joined in circles, feet rising and falling in mirth, the association of man and woman, each holding each other by the hand or arm. I was drunk with it, flushed of body and soul, delighted with the others, thrilled with reality. We approved, in the old sense of the term, that we saw this was good, probus. It was good, probus. What I'm suggesting is that we need to learn normalcy. If you really want to know what spring flowers and public dancing is about, they're about education in romance. But the divine romance of God's love for us. The divine romance of God's love for us. We want that, don't we? But how are we going to learn to live, to love, to taste, to be wise, to be well, to enter into the deep, beating, ordered loveliness of a reality created in the image of God if we don't offer ourselves and our friends and our parishioners something other than what the dreary culture is offering? So I'd ask that you keep Sabbath. Next Sunday, start small. Maybe just read a few lines of poetry. Or, my father-in-law uses this example. He grew up in a family where mom made Sunday gravy. You know, this is a dispute between North Jersey and South Jersey. Gravy is red sauce. I don't know why either. Gravy is red sauce. It was the best that his mother could do. So he went to Mass, did Eucharist, and then he had Sunday gravy. So Sunday tasted good. Sunday was a day of delight. So next week, turn off your TV, buy the best wine you can afford, have someone to dinner, serve Sunday gravy, or whatever your family does. The Sunday after that, invite a priest to dinner, read some poetry, sing the Salve Regina. The Sunday after that, learn a dance step. Best if you can play live music. If you can't, the record of the Hillbilly Thomists will do. Make the Sabbath sing, make it taste good. It's an education of the Trinitarian life, which is the life of communion and the life of happiness. This is a life of self-gift and reception, and it's the sort of self-gift which makes life larger and bigger and better
and more, and that's what happiness is. I'll end with this, these great lines from Hilaire Belloc, a reminder of how Catholics ought to live. Wherever the Catholic sun doth shine, there is always laughter and good red wine. At least I have always found it so. Benedicamus Domino, it sounds better with the heart. Thanks all, appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.